This excerpt is from the book, The Sacred Sequence, Remembering the One Truth. Thanks for listening. This is Chapter 1, The Essential Ingredients. How do you ever get to the truth and experience it? You dig through the layers of the illusions to remember your essence of pure love. In the process of passing through the layers of illusions, you may uncover some frustrating loops in your life and self-defeating choices. But you will come to find that these counterproductive ways provide the very opportunities you seek to reclaim your sacred self. You may also encounter forms of self-criticism and discover the roots of these, releasing the effects of past emotional traumas. You can identify and gain release from old patterns that led you into unsatisfying relationships with the same type of person. No judging allowed, just interpreting and understanding what you find and feel. Along this trek, you will discover a different way to understand forgiveness that assists you in reclaiming your true self and the freedom you desire. You will develop skills to transform self-criticism and unjust restrictions as you rise above the effects of past emotional trauma. You can discover and experience a healthy love and deep appreciation of yourself as you find that you are the person you always wanted to become. Your very being is of love, of the one source, all one. No human gave it to you, nor can anyone take it away. This is the one truth. You are this before your very first breath. I invite you now to join me as we begin this journey, tracing the stepping stones of the sacred sequence, returning back to the one truth. As noted in the prologue, the roots of this book extend back about 12 years to a dream that came to me one night. I was out of town and out of my routines, which so often creates an opening for new communication with Divine Spirit. So it was that night. This dream came to me in the form of a trilogy, one dream with three parts. The result of the dream is what I present to you now in this book that guided me from my illusions back to the sacred sequence and the one truth. The first part of this trilogy takes place in an unknown house. I stand inside a house with an unidentified man looking out through a large window at the surrounding countryside. The only thing I know about this man is that he is a very skeptical person. He's difficult to reason with and doubtful of anything beyond his own thoughts and beliefs. This skeptical one is totally convinced that a civil war rages in the surrounding countryside. Now, I know for sure that no fighting exists, but I also know that trying to talk him out of his belief is useless. While gazing out through the window, we suddenly see a massive explosion in the distance. A huge fireball billows up into the air. Several more explosions follow. I realize that this explosion reveals the unfolding of an ingenious scheme. The only way to change the skeptic's position is by acknowledging his belief that a civil war actually exists. So in this dream, someone creates the illusion of blowing up the rebels' ammunition dump. Now, with no ammunition left that could be used to fight the war ends, and he knows it. One illusion used to dispel another. The dream instantly shifts scenes, beginning the second part of the trilogy. I'm sitting at a small table at a sidewalk cafe. The house and skeptic are gone, replaced by a very pleasant outdoor setting at this cafe, where I meet an unknown woman. She sits down at the table next to me, holding a bag or a satchel of sorts. The woman leans over toward me and hands me the satchel, which contains a book. I couldn't see the book, but I could feel it in the bag and knew it was there. As she hands me the bag, she says, "I'm not sure if you will write it." Poof. Scene 2 ends. Next, the dream moves to scene 3 in a seamless yet abrupt manner. The third dream sequence opens with me standing next to a rather short man who resembles the wizard in The Wizard of Oz. This short, well-dressed man proceeds to tell me about the machinery and grid system that surrounds us in this huge, expansive, factory-like setting. As he explains, I express my amazement at this system. He humbly informs me that it was just a little something he had developed and put together. "This system just is," he tells me, "like numbers simply exist, never right or wrong." He suggests the following to me as an example. "Take the number 4. It just is, and is never wrong or right, and then you can take 4 times 4. And I wondered what the purpose of that was, so I asked him, "What's 4 times 4? He replies, "16s. I had to laugh, and yet I was also stunned at the same time. 16s. The wizard, who I sense is some embodiment of a divine spirit, goes on to tell me about 4 times 4. He says that 4 times 4 means faith, hope, love, and charity, applied toward God, self, others, and the universe in this order. It struck me that these particular qualities in this particular order seem to comprise some sort of sequence for well-being, a sacred sequence. Now, what would I do with what feels like such vital information? 4 times 4 equals 16s? What in the world? Well, I know that 16 represents an age at which we expand on our earlier life experiences and our beliefs out into the larger world. So whatever our belief foundation is at the time, especially from our family of origin, it becomes the one we usually rely on and project out into the world around us. Some of the dream symbols hold particular meanings, not just for me, but for others in general. The skeptic at the window with me seems to represent my primitive brain and its lack of trust and chronic skepticism. We each come with one of these skeptics within us. The civil war in the dream is the war that sometimes rages within self. We each experience the battle between those two factions inside, these different perspectives and beliefs that fight for supremacy, the negative voice and the positive voice. As we will come to find out later in the book, the presence of the primitive brain created illusions, and they represent a significant hurdle to overcome in our process of healing ourselves. In this dream, the skeptic held illusions that the war was real. However, we can't just let our spiritual self tell our skeptic, "Oh, you're mistaken, there's no war happening." The skeptic would not believe this at all. To reconcile and dispel illusions, we must treat them as real, and then arrange ways to diffuse and nullify them. This book provides numerous exercises that assist you in illusion busting. And finally, although we could assess this and most dreams for a really long time, the wizard character reveals a major truth. In the movie, The Wizard of Oz, we find that all the characters in their journey toward Oz eventually realize that they already possess within them the qualities they desire. So too, this dream conveys the unspoken message that we each already possess within us just what we desire. We are already the person who we always wanted to be. We just need to uncover, reclaim, and allow this emerging. You are the one who performs the process in and for yourself. While unraveling the messages of this dream, I continued working with my clients in my counseling practice. I recognized how we respond to trauma by turning the offender into some sort of all-powerful deity who determines our self-worth. We also rely on our primitive brain for coping, which is our least able aspect for daily living. In the process of reading some of the works of numerous spiritualists from various origins, along with additional training as a counselor, I learned and experienced that there exists a state of consciousness at the highest top end, where we merge into a sense of unity with God. Some call it Christ consciousness. This led me to the one truth. It is here in the place of unity that we each realize this one truth. We simply exist within this infinite, eternal love and actually consist of this. All doubts about self-worth and love-worthiness vanish, replaced by this one truth. Now we learn to live from this awareness and its amazing properties in our life as a human. I suggest that every act we choose is designed to either connect with the divine or maintain this connection. The core issue that interferes with remembering this one truth for each of us is the emotional traumas that we have experienced and our reaction to them. Every individual I know of has experienced some form of childhood trauma. It varies in degrees and severity. And such emotional upset just seems to be an inevitable part of life. The only tool we have available in childhood to make sense of this trauma is the ill-formed logic of a child. As a result, the child often ends up feeling like he or she causes the trauma and is worthy of the mistreatment that follows. Childhood logic may also result in forming some self-condemning beliefs, including doubts about love-worthiness. In this same way, a child then also forms misconceptions about God, relationships with other people, life, and how the divine universe works. The post-traumatic impact is that we form our self-concept and belief system based on the trauma instead of remembering our pre-existing love-worthiness. The reasoning abilities of the brain in childhood lead us to believe that some other person, the trauma inflictor, is our life source and can keep us alive or exterminate us. Just look at the power displayed by the offender as seen through the eyes of an innocent child. This places the offender in the God role. We then use other forms of limited thinking, which is our survival mode or primitive brain. This results in seeing others as our source of love-worthiness. We then try to extract redemption and love-worthiness from this person or those like the offender through our behavior and our accomplishments. Brief and fleeting success might happen, but the results fade quickly. We try to convert any success into a sense of love-worthiness. Based on this feat, we then hope to somehow bring this to God, who will then deem us worthy of love. In the meantime, this primitive brain reasoning has decided that God resembles the offender from childhood, unreliable, fickle, judging, and mostly rejecting and condemning. The sequence, the original sacred sequence, loses its sacredness, becoming out of order, starting with others now instead of God and proceeding to self, then to God, and then the universe. Using this sort of reasoning, we function from a place of misunderstanding as we venture out into the larger world. We live from a place where the one truth is that we are not love-worthy and search for how we can make up for this. We live based on inaccurate beliefs about God, self, others, and the universe, creating various forms of sickness or dis-ease, as it might be called, or dysfunction in our inner self and our lives. The after-trauma assumption is that we are somehow inferior and unworthy, so we must urgently find a way to correct our unworthy self. The solution, then, is to restore this original divine arrangement of faith, hope, love, and charity toward God, self, others, and the universe. The sequence is arranged back into the original order, God, self, others, and the universe. The result is streaming love-worthiness. This order allows us to remember our original and eternal love-worthiness. This sacred principle forms a sort of relationship between the four qualities and the four recipients, a sort of four-by-four relationship. Let me give you a brief example. Most of us have had an encounter along the way in our life of what I would call a bridge, in a sense, along our path that tells us we're not good enough. Now, I know I've crossed this bridge several times, and it tends to appear when I want to accomplish something. It's also interesting, I never get an answer when I ask that voice that tells me I'm not good enough. I ask, I'm not good enough for what? But I never get an answer. I do know that the voice comes from earlier life experience, and it asks me to prove my worth. This voice displays the very misalignment of the primitive brain. It believes that I may gain my worth after some accomplishment. This perspective reveals the disordered sequence of others, anything outside of self, such as people or accomplishments or possessions, which supposedly can be converted into others valuing us. So it starts with others, and then comes down to self, God, and the universe, and there is very little faith, hope, love, or charity in this. Now, what happens within the self when we apply the sacred sequence? We start with faith, hope, love, and charity toward God. With this, we rediscover our innate worthiness. We possess this just by our very existence. From here, we apply the same four qualities, faith, hope, love, charity, to ourself, then to others, and then the universe. And the universe in this case is nature, that which is unseen as well, animals as well. Once the sequence resumes, we find that there exists no such concept as good enough, because we exist good enough for all eternity. This four-quality set applied to the four recipients creates a tightly woven structure of four times four. Consider this. We don't expect infants to earn their worth, do we? I wonder at what age does the misconception come to life when we suddenly disregard the innate worth and our inner God, requiring proof of our worth? This requiring proof of worth is what I refer to as the fundamental error in the prologue. This fundamental error happens when we let our primitive brain decide the meaning of life events. The other part of this misalignment happens when we let our survival brain choose our response strategy in life. Since our survival brain is fear-based, each option it considers is geared toward preventing loss. It overlooks the infinite source of loveworthiness already present in us and around us. This limited thinking and awareness leads to choices that actually create what we fear. For example, we avoid interacting with people to prevent being rejected and ending up alone. However, we end up alone by not interacting with others. An odd shortcut for sure. Each choice of life management from the primitive brain suffers from what I call dyslexic logic. The primitive brain reverses both the source of self-worth and the effective solution. We do the exact opposite of what would help a situation. One of my clients expressed a reasoning that if she lets out these pent-up emotions that she was carrying inside, they will never end. However, the truth is that if she lets them out, they actually will end. And if she does not let them out, they will not ever end. The reasoning and response strategy is completely backwards. Decisions are based on the belief that things and people outside of us cause what we experience inside. The response is then based on a supposed outside source that holds our personal power and loveworthiness. Once we come to believe the misunderstanding of our primitive brain, we start living from a place where we feel diminished loveworthiness. Once we believe this, the next step is to compensate for the illusion. We attempt various feats intended to bring relief. These efforts just pull us further away from our inner loveworthiness that waits for us to remember. The primitive brain thinks in finite and tangible terms, so it believes that the source of the much sought-after loveworthiness is sort of like food and water in limited supply. Backtracking from the fundamental error and its ripple effects, we can recover lost parts of the self and restore the sacred sequence to remember this one truth. As we explore our primitive brain a bit closer, we find at least four core beliefs making up the operating system. These core beliefs are not all that comprise the primitive brain, but they strongly influence our thoughts, emotions, and behavior. The four core beliefs are: 1. All valuable aspects of life are external. They are finite and temporary. This is the paradox created by the trauma-fear brain. 2. The unwanted is permanent, while the positive is fleeting. 3. We either acquire the valuables or we do not, which creates emotional musical chairs. And 4. Primitive brain creates instant duality. Notice how it feels within if you believe that all power and valuables are external, finite and temporary, and you either acquire them or you do not. This musical chairs creates also a sense of us versus them. It creates an adversarial relationship and separates us from natural unity. These four traits, including duality, create also sort of instant byproducts of fairness, blame, and fault. If we expect an external source to solve our problems or bring us the resources we need, they're only going to let us down. Which the misconception leads us into the concepts of fairness, blame, and fault. Judgment represents another one of the ways the primitive brain tries to manage the illusions. Once we attempt to get our loveworthiness from an external source, it can only disappoint us. Then the primitive brain finds fault, blame, judgment, and similar reactions. It's as if living from the primitive brain leads us to end up with sort of leftover scraps of energy, and we just don't know what to do with them or how to get rid of them. And since we seek equilibrium by nature, we feel compelled to rid ourselves of the excess. However, when living from the sacred sequence and the one truth, there are no leftovers. We just live within one. Restoring this sacred sequence allows us to undo and remove the unnecessary painful illusions about ourselves. As we reverse the fallout of dyslexic logic, we can stop manifesting our fears and begin manifesting divine spirit. We then naturally extend and express this infinite love source toward others and our world. The result is faith, hope, love, and charity toward God, self, others, and the universe, returning you to the one truth.